And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook, live from Ohm here in the Netherlands, and not broadcast over the radio station in New York because we're not on tonight. If we were on tonight, we'd be on at 1 o'clock in the morning here, but it's actually a little bit after 8 o'clock in the evening. We're definitely not on at that time in New York, but we're not on later because we've been preempted for other reasons. But here I am, Emmanuel Goldstein. I'm joined tonight by Mike.
Hello.
Red Hacked.
Hello.
Welcome back. It's been a while since we've seen you.
Yeah, you know, that happens when you move.
Yeah. Kyle.
Hi.
Jens.
Hi.
You're actually on the air.
Yeah.
You're the guy who usually puts us on the internet by encoding the show afterwards.
But usually.
Here you are in the studio.
I don't have anything to do this week.
Bernie S. down in Philadelphia.
Yeah, greetings from the Netherlands. Hey,
you're here. That's right.
What's the name of the town we're closest to?
I think it's the camp is in Oudkaspel.
No, that's not the one.
Alkmaar.
Alkmaar.
Okay, very good. And Friday they have a cheese festival, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, cheese festival.
We're going there.
We got to go to the cheese. Do you know about the cheese festival?
No, I don't know.
It's a traditional thing. Dates back to the medieval times. And you go there and you watch cheese, but you can't buy it. You can only see it. It's kind of weird.
You can't eat medieval cheese there?
Well, you can buy it off somebody that got it. How did it work? Kyle explained it. I looked on the Wikipedia entry. If you look up this town on Wikipedia, they explain the whole thing.
It's sort of like a reenactment from what I understand, but there is a facility to somehow acquire cheese, but it's not through the reenactment. But you go, you watch, you figure out where to actually get cheese, and then you can get the cheese.
You reenact cheese?
You watch the process of a medieval cheese market be reenacted before your very eyes.
If you've never seen a medieval cheese market, you should watch the HBO miniseries first on medieval cheese. that's really where you learn about this stuff. By the way, that voice you heard just now was Mitch speaking before he was introduced, which is a grave radio sin.
I'm so sorry.
Mitch Altman, welcome to Ulm from wherever it is that you were traveling. Where did you come from?
Most recently Paris, but via Brazil.
Wow. It's amazing. You just go everywhere. I mean, you're traveling.
Isn't that a little bit out of your way to go to Brazil from France?
I don't know. Out of my way. Well, I mean, it's on the planet.
Well, it's true, but France is a lot closer to the Netherlands than Brazil. So, what was happening in Brazil?
There was a very large open source conference called FISL. They call it FISLI, the Forum for International Libre Software. So I was there to give a keynote talk to make it not about just software, but about open culture.
Awesome.
And did you succeed at doing that?
It seemed to go over well.
Uh-huh. That's cool. Yeah, I should say, we're doing this show. We're not on the radio in New York or the United States. We are in 104.7 here at this particular camp, and it spreads for miles because I don't know how many watts it is. Do you remember, Kyle? Did they tell us how many watts? I don't know.
I think Cy knows. Yeah, 20.
Yeah, 20 watts. Yeah.
20 watts.
And wow. It's reached in Alkmaar, too.
Yeah, I think we have a range almost of about 50 kilometers. That should be doable.
That's not bad for a hacker camp to be able to reach that distance.
What's interesting is the Dutch government offers a temporary licensing method, unlike the United States, where the FCC won't just give you a temporary license for a special event. How does that work here?
Well, basically, you just ask for a frequency and a license for an event, and they have a range of frequencies available for events, and then you say where the event is and when it starts, etc., and they look up a frequency which is not used in the area, and depending on your event, you get a license, yes or no. But you have to pull some strings because it's still pretty hard to get a frequency, and it was very last minute that we actually got the license. I think it was a week or a week and a half before, so it was a close call, but we managed. So,
well, it's a hacker conference. Of course, they pulled it off, but my point is, it would have been impossible in the United States to do this.
Is it?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Well, we would have been relegated to like low power, right?
Well, no, you know,
if at all.
You can't even get an LPMF license. You would have it broadcast in what's called Part 15 licensing, which is like less than 100 milliwatts, which you maybe cover like a few hundred feet.
Yeah.
That's nothing.
Okay.
I couldn't transmit to you. I'm looking at you across the room right now. That would be illegal for me to do that.
Bernie S. is in Philadelphia. Everyone knows that. Of course you couldn't reach him.
But this happened at HAR, too, 4 years ago. HAR FM was broadcasting. Does anybody remember the frequency of HAR FM? Anybody? Hands?
No.
You know, Breno just left the room. He would know. But there was it was an FM frequency just like here.
I can tell you.
Hey, Breno, what was the frequency of HAR FM? HAR FM.
I believe it was 102.7.
There you go.
That's not what it says on this
been corrected by Mike here. Okay,
I don't know. I mean, you would know probably better than the Twitter, but the Twitter said
106.8. Yeah, that's true.
Close. Let me ask you guys, how is it you have both even and odd frequencies when we only have odd frequencies in the United States? Bernie, maybe you understand this.
It's just the FCC just allocated only odd frequencies, like, you know, like 99.5, 99.7, 99.9. Here, I guess they decided to get more granular.
What is the bandwidth might be narrower here?
No, it's still 88 to 108.
I mean, they can fit more stations.
One station might be.
Oh, it's no. I've checked. It's still 75 kilohertz deviation, FM deviation. So the radios are compatible. It's still 88 to 108 megahertz. It's just they decided to be. I don't know. This is a very good question.
Uh huh. To which there is no apparent answer.
Well, I'm sure the National Association of Broadcasters, the lobbying arm for U.S. broadcasters for Congress, has a lot to do with it.
Point is, you guys can get radio frequencies here on a fairly regular basis. Yeah, it might be last minute, it might be pulling strings, but you do it. We never can do it. You've done it at HAR, you're doing it now at OLM. I'm sure that maybe What the Hack had it. I'm not really sure if there was a frequency there. Was there?
Okay. Yeah, there was one. I don't know what the frequency was. I think there was a sub-ether. It was doing a radio station. It's very small, but they had a frequency.
You should introduce yourself, by the way, for our listeners.
Excuse me?
You should introduce yourself.
Oh, okay.
Our engineer here.
Sorry. I'm Psychic.
Psychic.
Your engineer for today?
Yes, and he is psychic.
And he knows what we're going to say for the rest of the show.
Hopefully. Well, then you don't have to do the show anymore, right?
No, we'll get the rest out of here.
Someone's
good night,
everyone.
So, this is an additional Off the Hook, actual two-hour edition that's being broadcast here. And it's great. You know, somebody what's the town called?
Alkmaar.
Someone in Alkmaar, I'm sorry, if you're listening, just turned into 104.7, could hear us for the first time, never having heard anything on that frequency before. And that's kind of cool that we have that ability to suddenly start broadcasting. And it could happen anywhere at any time. That's the magic of radio. But we are doing a show on the things we usually talk about, which is technology and developments in espionage, surveillance, that kind of thing. Are there any new developments? Yes, there are. Well, first of all, yesterday there was the Bradley Manning verdict. Was anyone really surprised by this?
Pleasantly surprised. He was acquitted of one charge.
The worst one.
He did not aid the enemy, as we've said on this program, and as any sane person would immediately realize, but the judge finally agreed. But he was convicted of almost all the others, so that's pretty sad.
Uh-huh. And there were 20 charges he was convicted of. If you total it all up, maximum amount of jail he could get for those is 136 years. Does that include what he's already pled guilty to before the trial?
Yes.
It does. Okay, so 136 years. Sounds bad, and it probably is pretty bad, but what do we think? Do we think he's going to get anything near that, or half that, or significant, or is there any chance that that the judge will be fair?
No.
Yeah, we're pretty sure about that, I guess.
I mean, he's certainly going to jail for a long time. The sentencing part of the process, I guess, started today. And I guess we'll continue to watch that, but...
What does that mean exactly? The sentencing part started today. Does that mean that they start adding all the numbers together, or how does that work? Bernie, you might know something about this, being sentenced yourself.
I had to go through a sentencing thing. That was under federal criminal procedures. U.S. Code of Military Justice has different procedures, but a sentencing hearing still... It involves a lot of planning between the defense attorney and the... Between the defense attorney and the... prosecuting attorney, and they both present a lot of, with not really evidence under the federal system, on the federal criminal system, which I'm more familiar with, because rules of evidence don't apply. In the UCMJ, I don't think rules of evidence apply either. They just present statements about why, you know, sort of a exculpatory or minimizing, what do they call it, sort of like... The side against the defendant would say a lot of bad things about him, why he deserves harsh punishment. And then the defense attorney would say, well, he came from a bad, you know, he grew up in a bad family.
Like a character kind of profile or
right.
something?
Right. And rules of evidence really probably don't apply. It just has to do with the background information about the defendant and why they deserve a harsh sentence or why they deserve a lenient sentence. And there's a lot of stuff that's prepared for that. There are some attorneys in the U.S. that specialize just in sentencing stuff. because it's very complicated. And I'm hoping he has good representation in the UCMJ for that.
I don't know that he has special counsel, but his counsel that he's had, David Coombs, is finally allowed to present the evidence, which I think is extremely exculpatory, that he was not allowed to present during the main phase of the trial, which is evidence that Manning's actions have harmed absolutely no one. So that evidence will be presented, and maybe the judge will listen to it and give some reduction in the sentence.
Why was he not allowed to present that evidence during the trial?
I don't know. I don't understand how it works. I know that he wasn't. And
it is a military court system, very different than what we're used to. Kyle Knott actually went to the trial in Fort Meade, Maryland, and it was pretty bizarre and weird, different, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't know. One thing that struck me about we were going through the existing charges, not the one that was dropped, and a lot of them overlap. And I'm wondering if that might play a part in reducing them, or if all of them are going to stand. If they'll be a bit less, and across the board be a much less lesser sentence, because it kind of makes no sense to put someone in prison for 135 years, because I don't think as yet anybody's lived that long.
Well, that's. That happens, right?
Right, I mean, it happens, but it just seems a bit silly. I mean, what point? I mean, the point has been made. It's a pretty public case.
He might live to 100.
No, well, it's a silly, stupid 66. System. I mean, Bernie, was you telling me about the Ohio guy that, like, held those people prisoner for a decade or so, what he was sentenced
to? Yeah, he was charged with, like, hundreds of convicted of, or he pled guilty to hundreds of counts of rape and kidnapping and
but
so forth.
But each count.
Yeah, basically, he was sentenced to... like double-digit sentences, each of which was 1,000 years.
So you're sentenced to 1,000 years in prison, like 20 times?
A bunch of times.
It's insane.
Not just 1,000-year sentence, but a whole bunch of 1,000-year sentences.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's strange. In Norway, the guy who massacred those kids, they might remember his
Rager,
name.
Rager? I don't know how to pronounce it.
I don't want to remember his name, but he was sentenced to something like 30, 40 years. I'm not saying that's right. But at least it's somewhat sane than sentencing somebody to 1,000 years when humans don't live to be 100. It's just,
right,
silly and stupid.
Not as many people might have heard or followed that case, whereas in this situation, a lot of people are following this and a lot of people care about it. So it really making a kind of a spectacle of the sentencing, I don't think that's really necessary, but who mm-hmm. knows? I mean, yeah. I don't know what else is at play. We don't really know much about how this works. So maybe they do want to make a spectacle and make some outlandish sentence stick.
Yeah, it was weird though going down there, actually seeing Bradley Manning in person, and knowing that he's a part of this process. He's alert. He's paying attention. He's fighting for his life. And it was a bit of history in the making, and I just hope that he somehow gets through this. It's tough, though. And what he has done for the world, for us as individuals, cannot be overstated. He just basically has changed history by revealing certain things that might never have been revealed otherwise, or certainly many, many years in the future.
Well, I wanted to point out one of the differences in the sentencing between the United States Code of Military Justice and our federal Department of Justice, you know, criminal trials, is that they can sentence you to hard labor in the military justice system.
That's an interesting distinction.
Yeah, they can't do that in the federal criminal system, and it's not uncommon for people who are court-martialed of serious things to be sentenced to, you know, tens of years.
Mm-hmm. Any idea of what hard labor means nowadays?
One can only guess, but you know, it probably amounts to physical, what some people would describe as physical and psychological torture. If you're day after day. Yes, it reminds you of, like, there's those Soviet prison camps, the Gulag, where they'd send you there to break rocks and dig holes and fill them back in again, and who knows, but, I mean,
oh, like
hard labor.
Oscar Wilde got convicted and sentenced to so many years of hard labor, and that's basically what killed him.
Yeah, so that is in play here, a potential sentence of hard labor for who knows how many years for Bradley Manning.
Didn't Fiber Optic go to a prison that also built furniture? I'm wondering if it's worse than building furniture.
Yeah, I believe the company was called Unicor. It's part of the federal prison system. Basically what they do is they build furniture for pennies an hour, some ridiculous crap like that. and consumers buy this.
No, well, no, they can only sell to federal customers.
Like federal customers.
Yeah, the furniture would only be used at federal agencies. Otherwise, it would violate certain laws.
Well, don't they eventually run out of federal agencies to supply with furniture?
No, it's just the deal. The Unicor only is allowed to, by federal law, is only allowed to manufacture. The federal prison industries, Unicor, is only allowed to manufacture products will be used by federal agencies.
Yeah, but can those federal agencies then resell them afterwards to? I have something that says Unicor on it. So I don't know how I got
the federal prison where I was. They had a factory there that manufactured electrical cables for like F-16 jet fighters.
Wow!
I wasn't there long. I didn't get a chance to make the cables, but
hey, you're always going to regret that.
It was in the
you?
Cards. I could have.
The commercially available products made in prisons generally come from China.
Okay.
Yes,
that's probably true as well. So yeah, Bradley Manning, that was the big story. Now he's the sentencing hearings will probably go on for a bit of August, and we won't really find out for a few weeks. I think that's the consensus. That's going to take a while.
Who knows? It won't be quick. It'll take at least days.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, of course, that story broke as far as him being found not guilty of the most important charge and guilty of the 20 other charges. That broke the very moment that this radio station went on the air. Yeah. So I think that's very interesting that that Ohm started with a real bang. Let's talk.
I want to bring up something important, is that this while the U.S. Code of Military Justice decisions, those decisions don't set a legal precedent for U.S. criminal courts, I still think it's a political precedent for this concept of a whistleblower or leaker being charged with aiding the enemy being found not guilty, because this had far-reaching consequences for journalists in the United States who would do their jobs by asking sources for information and be potentially liable for criminal prosecution for aiding the enemy. Because, you know, think the enemy might possibly read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or any other, you know, newspaper or media. I mean, the implications were really serious here. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, we'll talk about it in a bit, but we can find out if the enemy is reading the New York Times. The NSA, at least,
find out. Yeah. That's right.
Well, yeah. Is the NSA the enemy?
The NSA is maybe my enemy.
Just wondering.
Wait, the NSA can find out who's reading the New York Times. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
All right. Well, how do they do that?
Should we talk about this story?
Let's talk about this story.
So this is Glenn Greenwald, who got all these documents from Edward Snowden, did another piece today.
Glenn Greenwald being the Guardian reporter that revealed this. Okay.
Yep. About a program, an NSA program called X Key Score. Which is a really vague name, but what it lets the NSA do is it... So the NSA apparently has ways, which are not detailed here, of getting a hand on all internet traffic, and what X Key Score does is it allows them to query all this traffic remotely so that they don't have to transmit all the traffic to Maryland for further analysis, because transmitting all that would be highly suspicious. So they can get... all this information, basically anything on the internet. There's this great slide. I'll see if I can find it. Why use HTTP? And the answer is because the internet is made of HTTP. HTTP is the protocol you use when you browse the web, and X Key Score can search it. So they give some examples here. What can you do with X Key Score? You can look for anomalous events. So you can say, show me all the encrypted Word documents in Iran. Show me all the PGP users in Iran.
Whoa. Stop. Show me all the PGP... I'm seeing here. Show me all the PGP usage in Iran. They can just do that immediately.
Right. So this program at least can't decrypt it. We don't know if they can decrypt it some other way, but the NSA can say, hey, everyone in Iran who is sending encrypted email, I want a list of them. And this X Key Score will apparently do it.
This was just released today?
Yep.
Late breaking news here. Yeah.
So basically, they've got
Like 2 o'clock British time. I don't know what time that is. Any other time today?
So basically, they've got things that are analyzing the streams of data, probably when they're on the ISP networks, and it's basically like a grep. It sounds like grep the internet.
Basically, yep. grep not just grep the internet, but grep the usage of the internet.
And of course, you have the situation where, you know, they may not be able to get this kind of in-depth access in other countries, but a lot of the services used around the world are in the U.S. And so the
there's a map.
But in they this can do case, it on Iran.
What Mike is saying is they can do this in Iran. One user in Iran sends a PGP message to another. Hang on. One user in Iran sends a message to another user in Iran using PGP. And you're saying the NSA can tell us.
That's the claim on this slide.
So it's not like the NSA has agreements with ISPs in Iran.
I don't
think they're doing it another way without the agreements.
Right. How can they won't have an agreement with anyone in Iran.
Well, they didn't. I mean, they've already revealed that they're like slurping data from like the major backbones of the internet, right? So if you send a message from one person to another in Iran, at some point it goes through the internet backbone and that's where they're getting it?
There's a map.
In real time.
And again, I don't know what this map is, this ugly thing with a bunch of red dots on it, but there's definitely dots in the Middle and Near East. There's dots all over Europe for our European friends. There's a few dots.
It's a lot of dots.
Where the transoceanic cables enter and leave the United States. There's dots in Central America.
Why all
Australia?
Those dots up by Antarctica? There's a whole lot of dots.
Yeah, I don't know what's up with that. I think someone's just having a fun time with some dots. But.
The U.S. intelligence community has actually a long history of tapping data cables in and out of what it would describe as unfriendly countries. So, yeah, including going to extreme lengths to do that, like going to the bottom of the sea with submarines to tap into fiber optic cables and copper cables. They do this.
I want to go back to some of the examples. And these are examples that the slide deck is a training slide deck. So, like, hey, new NSA employees, here's what you can do. You can say, show me all the VPN startups in country X and give me the data so that I can decrypt and discover the users.
Discover the users.
You can decrypt. You can say, my target speaks German but is in Pakistan. How can I find them? How can you find them? You can look for people when you use a web browser, you probably have it set to what languages you speak so that the remote server will give you content in your language. So XKeyscore can search that and find everyone in Pakistan who's requesting their websites come up in German.
That data sent in your HTTP headers by your browser.
I have a jihadist document. What's that?
I have a jihadist document that has been passed around through numerous people. Who wrote this and where were they?
Wow.
Yes, I'd like to get their
that's
autograph.
Pretty serious.
Please introduce me to them.
Show me the Microsoft Excel spreadsheets coming out of Iraq so I can perform network mapping. And this is my favorite, I guess, if you're allowed to have favorites among evil. Show me all the exploitable machines in country X, so presumably so that they can then break into them.
And that one's called DAO, T-A-O?
Fingerprints from DAO are loaded into XKeyscore's engine. The data is tagged in database. You need no strong selector. Complex Boolean tasking and regular expressions are required, whatever that means.
Now, how does this fall outside of needing a warrant? I understand in other countries we don't need warrants for wiretapping if they're foreign.
They're aliens.
Can these searches be done within the U.S. too on just anybody?
No, the slides are relatively clear that you're only supposed to use this for outside the U.S. But we have many people. We're surrounded by thousands of non-U.S. people, many of whom I care about. And I don't buy this distinction between U.S. and non-U.S. persons.
I was just asking.
Yeah. What about the three hops rule?
Didn't the FISA stuff and a lot of stuff we've been talking about, like if you're communicating with somebody outside the country, you're susceptible. It's not like domestic communication might need a warrant, but if you even talk to someone.
Well, what's this thing you're talking about? Warrant? Weren't there a bunch of people spied upon by a certain three-letter acronym agency that was just released by a guy named Snowden without warrants?
Mm-hmm.
It was it was a general warden, which is specifically prohibited in the U.S. Constitution.
That thing again.
Yeah.
Keeps getting in the way, doesn't it?
It would if people paid attention to it. But Mike, where did this information come from? Is there any indication or just some unspecified source?
That is not shown. There's a few slides that The Guardian has blocked out, and I'm not really clear why, so it might be in there or it might just not be part of this deck at all. I guess as an NSA employee, you're probably not encouraged to ask such questions.
I thought that hadn't Snowden provided them with a lot of things and they hadn't necessarily released them all, or is this a new?
This is something new to us.
Newly leaked. But it might have been included in the original leak.
That's my assumption.
Yeah, that's.
Hey, I have a question. Why would the NSA have just like voluntarily announce this? What were their motivations?
They gave it to their employees.
Okay, I'm mishearing it. I'm thinking about another story.
Okay, yeah, we're going to get to that story, but this was leaked by Snowden.
Presumably.
Okay, so this came out.
Yeah, the administration, I think, acknowledged this or they, I don't know. They kind of admitted that this exists. I don't think this existed yet.
There is a statement from the NSA in this article. I'll see if
I mean,
you can guess what it says. It says, but
is it the least most untruthful comment? Is that what?
Here's the statement from the NSA. The NSA's activities are focused and specifically deployed against and only against legitimate foreign intelligence targets in response to requirements that our leaders need for information necessary to protect our nation and its interests.
Does everyone feel secure as a result of that statement? I thought so. Yeah.
Feel less secure, frankly.
Well, interesting.
I think it makes sense. I mean, assuming this is from the Snowden leak, it kind of makes sense to publish them over time. You don't want to kind of throw everything out at once just because, you prolong the story by releasing it bit by bit.
That's what I saw an interview with Greenwald. Is that his name?
Glenn Greenwald, yes.
Yeah. And he had said that Snowden gave them everything all up front at the beginning, and they're going through everything and vetting it all and writing the stories now. So there's going to be more to come out, but he's basically leaked everything all at once.
Yeah.
We assume that he's leaked everything that he has to leak and that it's all in the hands of the media now that will decide what is safe to release and what is not. And this is one example of something that we have just received today, and the world is going through it. And Kyle, you just said, I think it's true, that the slides at least look a little better.
Yeah, the X is really nice.
yeah, it is a nice X, but I want to show you how many hours did that process. I want to show you, Kyle, and we'll describe for our listeners on the air this graph. This is a graph of processing speed and processing depth, and what it's trying to say is that X key score is more deep but slower than these other programs called Turmoil and Turbulence.
Wait, the programs are called Turmoil and Turbulence?
Yeah, not what they caused, but the names of the programs. But
I want to know about these programs.
I'm making a point about graphic design here.
Yeah.
Which is that what this slide should do is it should have a dot down here for slow and deep for X key score, and a dot up here for faster but not as deep for the other two programs. Instead, what they've done is drawn these two weird triangles, and it's really like one of the triangles has a line coming out the top. It's very poorly designed.
Didn't the Bee Gees do a song, "How Deep Is Your Data Mining"?
Listen. The Turmoil/Turbulence. So there are two programs in the NSA, one called Turmoil, one called Turbulence. That's what I want to know about those. Has there been any leak about these
programs?
Maybe
we'll find out.
Yeah. Wow. There's also this guy. Slower. X key score is slower.
Yeah, what's up with that guy at the computer terminal?
Deeper.
He's running a query.
Uh-huh. Okay, we have an NSA employee here that's graphically represented.
Is it a cartoon?
Yeah.
He's connected to what looks like a very large oil tank.
Right, by a query.
It does look like that.
There's a two-headed query arrow going between him and the oil
tank. It's a tank full of data.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Wow. And look at that. Look at that. The third line, log ins. Like, it's two words, log in. I just think that's
how many logs are in the oil tank.
So the NSA can spy on all of us and read all our internet traffic, but they can't spell or hire a graphic artist.
Or search their own email.
All right. I think there's clip art there, too.
Okay, see, this is one story. This is what we just heard about today, about the Snowden leaks. But there's another leak that happened today by the U.S. government themselves. And, in fact, we're trying to think of a name. Maybe listeners can help us with this. When the U.S. government decides to preemptively leak something before it gets leaked through Edward Snowden...
It's a preemptive strike.
It's kind of like a preemptive leak, yes, but I think there's a better word for it out there somewhere.
We want to convey that it was done disingenuously to try to spin it. I came up with spin leaking, but...
A what?
An upstream leak?
Upstream leak. Okay, that's a possibility.
But you got to imply that it's being done for political spin purposes. I suggest spin leaking, but there's probably a better word than that.
They're leaking this because
leak spinning.
If Snowden leaks it, they look bad. If they leak it before Snowden does, then he can't leak anything.
I don't know if there's any truth to this, having no experience with three-letter acronym agencies personally, but someone I met who claims to be an ex-person from one of these agencies.
Ex-person?
Ex-employee, affiliate, whatever. He's certainly still a person, but he claimed that there's this notion of derailment. Or derailing.
Yes.
So people in these agencies will put out something that seems truthful, that may or may not be truthful, entirely truthful, partly truthful, who knows, that is damning, but not as damning as some journalist or someone on the hot on the trail of something that's way more damning.
Well,
but
connect you, it through history.
Yeah, well, you put out this this tidbit that seems juicy and is damning, and then people will all start following that, like lemmings, and leaving the real tracks going to the very damning thing unexposed.
Stealing the thunder of the real leaker.
So you know, this might be what's happening. That may or may not be happening. I have no way of knowing. We can only guess.
You're listening to Off the Hook here on Ohm Group Radio, here in wherever we are in the Netherlands, 104.7 FM. Special two-hour edition of the radio show. Now, okay, so we talked about this this leak, this preemptive leak, whatever we want to call it. Maybe maybe listeners out there can run down to the radio tent and come up with a better name that we can use for this kind of thing. Because apparently this is a strategy now by the U.S. government. Before Snowden can leak it, they're going to leak it first and put their own spin on it. So the story that was leaked today by the U.S. government, Mike, is what?
I don't know nothing. They released, I'm still trying to figure out exactly what they released. They released an order from the FISA court explaining why they released the, explaining the order that was previously leaked about the production of the telephone data. And so there's a little bit of rationale here. I'm not going to be able to read it and summarize it while we're still on the air. And it's nice. We should get this data, but it doesn't tell us anything new about what the NSA is doing.
I see a bit of redaction there, too. I see some crossed out words.
Yeah, it's fairly heavily redacted. The
for your own security.
The caption of the case, as they call it, which says who is involved, is almost entirely redacted. So it's an application of the FBI, presumably at the behest of the NSA, for an order requesting the production of tangible things, which is a wonderfully bizarre way of saying give us access to your database, from and then there's like, I don't know, what is this, 10 lines of blacked out text saying who the data is coming from. So it's way too long to just say Verizon, but we don't know who else is in there.
It's probably a whole, it's like all kinds of ISPs and phone companies and stuff. Hey,
Bicycle Mark has arrived from someplace, and sit down. We have many microphones here.
Pull up a chair.
So many microphones.
Bicycle Mark.
Yes, absolutely.
Say hello.
Oh, hello. I thought I was gonna have to take a turn or something. I walk right in and I get service.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like Burger King.
But I've been separated. I have this shiny light on me. I'm on my own over here.
There's a seat next to me.
That's very far away, but at least I can tell that we're on the air.
Bicycle Mark, has your talk already happened?
My talk has already happened
just two hours ago. I missed it. Tell us
about
your talk.
There's no printed schedule
in
this
wait,
thing.
Give your talk again.
I probably could.
There's time.
I've compacted them.
It was quite good. In only 30 minutes, we could fit you in.
I assume that you always tell the truth when you're on the air.
Yeah, we try to, but sometimes we don't.
Yeah, he looked like he was telling the truth. yeah, my talk was on, you really do want to know, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay, just checking. Hi, Mitch. the only person I hadn't really seen. But my talk was on, I worked with Syrian journalists who came over the border to Turkey, where I was, to meet them. And I gave basically video storytelling training, and in the process learned a lot about the current lives of people who still live in Syria, but specifically people who have decided, because of circumstances, they're going to report on what's happening, everyday life, not just the war, but you know, children going to school, weddings, every little thing, garbage. They've dedicated their lives to it because they don't want to leave their city, and they really want the world to know. And so they're struggling with that question also of how do we get the world to want to know, to pay attention. And thankfully I have some experience where I can, I've never really had to work a camera when I'm getting shot at, but I've worked enough cameras where I can teach you how to better frame a shot. We can talk about sound. We can talk about lighting. And for them, they had skipped that whole thing. A lot of them had become journalists out of necessity. They were studying other things. They were studying sciences. And then they went to the protest, which was initially a peaceful protest. It was just against the president and in favor of democracy. And then, of course, they were met by violence and the war eventually started. And instead of picking up guns, as many friends certainly did, they decided they're going to pick up their mobile phone camera and start documenting and start trying to report. And over time, they've managed, in some cases thanks to outside help, they've managed to upgrade that mobile phone camera to a better camera. They've learned more about photography. Thankfully, there are some, I credit NGOs, maybe within Syria too, there are people who have taught them that can come and say, okay, here's how you do video editing, and that I did that. So it was amazing. I mean, I hopefully was useful to them, but they were extremely, I wouldn't even use the word useful, they were just extremely, they were teachers to me about a different kind of life and the value of life to some extent. It was amazing. So I came to camp, and I actually hadn't planned on giving a talk, but in the last few weeks, basically one of the organizers convinced me that I could come and talk about my experience, which I always love about camp, because you'd think, well, this isn't exactly hackerish or, you know, in the traditional sense, but I'm always allowed to bring new topics here.
Well, let me say, Vasco, Mark, you are one of the most courageous journalists I know. You've been to Afghanistan. You've been to so many places in the world where things really are not safe. And yet you report audio and through your blog and various other ways. How do you make these connections?
I've sacrificed, I think, the idea. Some people would say it's a nice thing, but I've never taken a real job. I've always kept myself free for things that may come up. And I keep my ears open, and if somebody says, hey, you, or they use my name sometimes, we'd like to go do a project in X country, are you going to be available? And I try to always say yes. I also keep my ears open for when it sounds like a good situation or not. I do care about my safety, but at the same time, I'm willing to, maybe willing to go a little further. But I'm in no sense... a war reporter. There are people who put themselves in far better, bigger danger. Mm-hmm. But I do like to go to places where, I don't know, I guess some people wouldn't. Or the whole thing, you know, when you don't have a university, when you don't have an educational program, that's the kind of place where I like being able to provide some of that.
Mark, I've read your weblog, and it's fascinating. And what's the URL for that again?
Citizenreporter.org.
And some really riveting reading on there about the places you've been and the people you've had shared experiences with, and the incredible risk and danger they're putting their own lives in to get important stories out to the rest of the world. This is just mind-bogglingly important stuff worth reading.
Yeah, and I mean, I was just thinking of something I didn't share in the talk today, but... You know, you talk about people who put themselves at tremendous risk, and it's not for profit. You know, it's simply for the idea that somebody's going to want to know. And even if they can't get people to listen in the rest of the world, a lot of times they say, someone has to talk about this. It'll be in history books. It'll be documented. Even if nobody's going to read it on a front page today, they will know that this person died and how they died and why, you know, maybe why. There were students who, this is how kind they are, they wanted to teach me something. I'm saying they already taught me something, but they really wanted to teach me something practical. And you'd think Arabic, and I am working on that. But since we were in a hotel where we were put up to do this project, one particular student said, I love swimming. I don't know if you know this, but some Syrians love to swim. How's your swimming? And I said, I swim okay. And he goes, you could improve it. Come to the pool tonight. And I was already... humbled, you know, that a Syrian wants to teach me to swim better. I'm in. I went to the pool. He takes off his shirt, and he's ready to swim. He's got three bullet holes. Shoulder. There's three. I think some of them were exit wounds. He had been shot by snipers three times in the last 2 years.
Jeez.
On three separate incidents. And I looked at it, and I paused a little, and you don't want to stare, right? But I said, and he goes... yeah, I'll tell you those stories. And he did tell me those stories later. He starts teaching me, you know, let's go over the freestyle. Let's go over the backstroke. And he actually tries to move the arm that's been most affected by the wounds, and it doesn't really move. And he looks at his shaky arm and he goes, "Forget this." And he just swims with one arm, and he's so fast and he's so excellent. But he just, to him, you know, he was just moving on. Gotta move on. Gotta show you this. Yeah, this arm, I can't shake your hand. I can't grip anything. And I would say, "Well, are you going to keep doing what you're doing?" And he said, "Absolutely. I'm here until this is over. And then maybe I'll do something else." I even asked him what he'd like to do. And he wouldn't give me an answer. He said, "We got to get through this. I got to keep doing my job. I got to get better. I got to listen to you." He would give me credit. He'd say, "I got to listen to you and follow these steps to be a better editor." And it was amazing.
That is beautiful. That is amazing. Now, this is somebody you met in Turkey?
They came over the border from Syria because the organization deemed it safer that they could come out, pay some border guards, and be housed in a hotel, as there are a good amount, and their trainers could come. I came from Amsterdam, and someone came from the U.S., actually, and we were their trainers for a week. There was even someone there doing cyber security for them a bit, which is a big issue, and I'm it's not even my specialty. It should be more of my specialty, but they also came to talk about that for Syrians and reporting from Syria. So, and what a juxtaposition, too, to be, we were in Istanbul, in a pretty decent hotel, you know, far above my normal standards. And there are the Syrians, and they're living in buildings that are barely standing. And they're moving bedrooms every night, these guys especially. And here we are in, like, you know, tourists everywhere. And they wanted to go out and eat well. And I said, "Is it hard to enjoy yourself when back home people are being bombed?" And they said, "Sometimes yes, but at the same time, we hope that our country will be like this one day." And then, you know, you get, like, they look at each other like Turkey? Yeah, I like Turkey, you know. So you see that they, you know, I thought that I would be sort of ashamed that I live in a country where we can have fun, because we are having fun right now at this place. And they said, "No, we would do the same thing. We would do the same thing in your position, and we hope to do that later, you know."
Are these guys that are going to go back to their country? Are they there temporarily?
They all go back. They come over the border because, and it's funded by an organization, but they come over the border for training. And I don't think I'm putting them at any risk by talking about this. They wanted me to tell their story. And the organization, I think, has something to be proud of, because they make it happen financially and logistically, that the Syrians can come over. And it's not that far, well, you know, 6 to 8 hours. It's like American distances. And they stay for a week, they get their training, and then they go back. And I wondered how many people would say, like, "I'm not going back." But they didn't say that. They all said, "No, we'll go back, we got work to do."
How do you feel about possibly going over there yourself?
I would, and maybe I will one day, but I don't want to be a burden, or I don't want to get in the way. There are reporters, they've been working on it for some time. You got to start somewhere, so maybe, you know, that's how I should look at it. But I look at it as, I don't want to slow them down. I don't want to put them at risk just because they have to show me. I'd rather they do it, but I would love it, as I think you would too, a chance to get to see it. And the way we left it, of course, is once this war is over, first thing, you got to come say hello. You got to come see. We'll show you, and we can talk. We can tell the stories. So I'm not in a rush to get there now, because I don't think I would be as useful as I would be a nuisance. But, you know, they're such lovely people, by and large. They would say, "You're not a nuisance. You're welcome." And you know, who knows the truth? But yeah. I wouldn't want to get in the way.
Well, oftentimes, people in the most horrible conditions are the most generous and giving in their cultures. I have no trouble at all seeing how this ties into the hacker community and how this can be presented at a conference like OHM. Does anybody want to speak to that? Like, why this is something that we embrace?
I think it's perfectly appropriate.
Yeah, me too. Hacking is not just about technology, as we all know. It's a way of looking at things, an ethos, a way of living. And, you know, as I always define hacking, it's taking what is in our world and improving upon it and sharing it. And journalism is certainly, that's what good journalism does.
Mm-hmm. The two sharing. Of you travel more than anybody I know, Mitch and Bicycle Mark. And it's incredible that you're doing all these different things. But yeah, it all ties together so well.
I think it's important to remember this is not a technology conference. The Black Hat conference is going on today, which is a security conference. And people may know, their keynote speaker today was General Alexander, the head of the NSA. And I think that just goes to show you the difference between that conference and this one, that they have General NSA. We will have Julian Assange speaking later. We had this morning Ray McGovern, a CIA, a former CIA person, talk about what's wrong with that agency. And we will not have General Alexander.
Did General Alexander say anything? of interest.
Did he wear blue jeans?
I don't know what he wore. Again. I mean, this is how he distracts us from talking about the real issues. We talk about his wardrobe.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's a world of difference over here in the Netherlands right now, and we have so many diverse topics to discuss and focus on, and I just think what you guys do, what Bicycle Mark does, and Mitch, you traveling around the world as well, enlightening people in various ways, is so important to the hacker community and to the rest of the mainstream, so that they can learn things from people like you guys. Mm-hmm. What kinds of things do you do when you travel, Mitch?
I do various different things. I guess one of the overarching things, I mean, in the particulars, I teach people how to solder and do workshops teaching electronics, but the main thing is helping people organize to create community that works for them as they see it, and it's through hackerspaces mainly. I went to Egypt a couple of years ago, and Mark, you went shortly after me, and I connected you with people, and that worked really well. Going there, this was after Mubarak had been gone for not quite a year, and after, you know, decades of abuse, and people were afraid. People were ready to do incredible things, but it took someone from the outside, and there's a friend of mine, Bilal. Have you met Bilal?
I've spoken with him through email, but never met in person.
Yeah, he's here at OHM.
Oh, our Bilal. I'm sorry. I was thinking of go on. I know Bilal.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it was his idea to do this, and we went to Maker Faire Africa, and we set up with Bilal's organizing a whole bunch of people to come together for hackerspace meetups, and the first one was like 35 people, the next one was like 80 people, the next one was over 100, and everyone thereafter was over 100. And hackerspace started in Cairo, and many started thereafter, and they're cruising. All it took was some people from the outside to just poke, and they were ready. And it's amazing what people can do with whatever scarce resources seem to be available. There's always lots of resources, whether it's money or space or just human energy. People getting together, we can do amazing things when we pool our resources. And it can be in a place that is just opening up like crazy, like Egypt, or now, oddly enough, China. There's still a long way to go in both of these places, and both of these places are so messed up. All culture has things that are in the way and that are assets. But showing people through my outside perspective what I see as assets for people to come together and pool their resources, people just are ready to cruise. And I love playing that role whenever I can.
Mm. It's interesting to see in the context of camp, Hacker Camp, and the congresses over the years. I've only been coming here since 2000, maybe around 2005, just after must have been What the Hack. And I've noticed with every meeting, with every great event, a lot of discussion about other countries, about the world, about not only problems, but projects that are being done. And I kind of love how, basically, as you said, this is all related to what we're doing here. It's not just technology, it's life, and it's life in different parts of the world. And it's neat to see, you know, I gave a small talk about Syria. There are probably four talks about Syria going on in the next few days, and by people who have done amazing things and are still working on the topic and are fantastic, and they're here, and it doesn't even surprise me anymore. You know,
we had at the most recent Hope conference, Hope number 9, we had so many submissions for the Arab Spring things, how they relate to the world of hacking, and it was no trouble at all scheduling them and figuring out, yeah, this is something that is relevant. I do remember when we first started doing conferences back in the 90s, it was a lot more just focused on technical things, issues, technology, things like that. And H2K was our conference in 2000, the year 2000, where we sort of broke away from that and started to become more of the activist bend and political. And we got a lot of crap from people saying, don't be political, keep hacking separate from politics. But you can't. You can't keep that separate. They're related. They're so intrinsically connected. And that's something I think we learned from Germany at the CCC events, that politics is a vital part of all of this. And it's certainly brought out here at Ulm, and it will be brought out at our future conferences. And I can't say they'll be brought out everywhere. Some will just be security conferences, and I think pretty boring, but other ones like this will bring out a variety, and you'll have talks about Syria and the Arab Spring and all kinds of world events and see how they relate to the things that we do.
I think, though, that to say that something purely technical is apolitical is dangerous. I think it's, in fact, a very dangerous type of politics to pretend that, you know, putting the head of the NSA on stage, who is allegedly an apolitical figure, is not a political act. I think that's almost so naive as to be willfully naive.
They don't know it's being political, but yes, it is being political.
So I don't buy the argument that one group of people is political and some other group isn't.
If they don't think they're being political, they think they're being technological only, and their stupidity is actually a political statement, I'm going to say that, yeah, they really don't know that they're political. And it's funny. It's great. It ties in so incredibly, and yeah, you have to be blind not to see that. You are listening to Off the Hook here on radio at Ulm. Ulm Roop, is that the name of the place?
Ulm Roop.
What
yes,
does that mean
right.
Exactly?
Ulm Roop is a kind of a joke against the regular Dutch broadcast stations here in the Netherlands are called Ulm Roop. So,
okay.
Yeah, so basically it was pretty obvious that we had to make some fun of that and make it Ulm Roop.
No idea.
So it's basically Ulm Roop is just a name for a broadcast station.
Uh-huh.
So we just
All right, well, that's what we are. 104.7, we're broadcasting right now. Can we have a time check? There's no clock in here. I have no idea what time it is.
It's just 9 now.
Just 9 o'clock, and we're on for another hour.
You're on for another hour.
All right, a special edition of Off the Hook, when we're not actually on in New York, which... it's interesting. Wednesday nights, usually we're broadcasting at 7 p.m. Eastern time, which is, I think, 1 o'clock in the morning here or something like that. But tonight we're not on, so we're broadcasting at a more reasonable time here in the Netherlands.
We're not getting much sleep here. Ulm is not about sleep. So 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, 4 in the morning, whatever.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood, but little no.
You've been listening to a special edition of Off the Wall and Off the Hook, recorded at the Ulm 2013 Hacker Camp on July 31st, 2013. Next time, we'll continue our Dutch radio broadcast with the conclusion of this two-hour broadcast. Until then, this is Emmanuel for Off the Wall. Have a good night.
Interested in seeing some live roller derby action?
Roller derby, you say?
Yes, come see the Strong Island Derby Revolution, Suffolk County's only women's flat track roller derby team.
I'm Bite Size Barola, number 411.
And I'm Malokia, number 2020.
On June 7th, we'll be holding our third annual charity brawl at World Gym in East Setauken. This year's theme is Track to the Future, featuring Team 1980s versus Team 1950s, and we're debuting some of Strong Island's newest skaters.
Each year, our skaters hit the track and each other for charity. This year, we will be helping WUSB 90.1 FM raise money to replace their radio transmitter.
Doors open at 7 and the first whistle's at 8. Bring a chair and sit trackside if you want to get close to the action.
Live entertainment, raffles, and lots of derby action. Remember, kids under 8 are always free.
For more information, visit our website at www.thederbyrevolution.com or www.wusb.fm.
Hope to see you on June 7th at World Gym, 384 Marktree Road in East Setauken.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
A9 North is hosting a benefit concert for WUSB on Sunday, June 8th.
Appearing at this fundraiser will be Dave Christian, Danny Keen, Mind Open, The Well Diggers, Small Craft Warning, The Diamond Jig Band, Katie Perlman, Froom featuring Frank Salenza, and the host of Bluegrass Time on WUSB, Buddy Merriam with Backroads.
There will also be 50-50 raffles, door prizes, and a chance to meet WUSB DJs and behind-the-scenes staff who volunteer their time to bring you our unique programming.
Tickets are only available on the day of the show. Doors open at 1 p.m. Music starts at 2. That's on Sunday afternoon, June 8th, from 2 to 8 p.m. at 89 North Music Venue on North Ocean Avenue in Patchogue. All proceeds go toward keeping WUSB on the air
and bringing you the best in non-commercial freeform radio. We'll see you there for some great local music.
My kids, this is Finn with you on Finn's Revolution on WUSB Stony Brook, right here until the 9 p.m. hour, and we're going to be hearing mostly nothing but music, but give away some tickets to the Cinema Arts Center screening of the Great Slint documentary, and also we're going to speak with Esther Anderson, Jamaican beauty queen, friend of Bob Marley. Stay tuned.
The moon is there for us to share, but where are you? A night like this, could weave a memory, and every kiss could start a dream for two. Full moon and empty arms. Tonight I'll use the magic moon to wish upon. And next full moon, if my one wish comes true, my empty arms will be filled with you. Tonight I'll use the magic moon to wish upon. And next full moon, if my one wish comes true, my empty arms will be filled.
B.B. Baron in the background doing the ancient Krell music from Fantastic Planet. Forbidden Planet. I'm sorry. Forbidden Planet. I'm losing track here. Before that, Herman's Hermits. A Must to Avoid. And before that, Suspicious Beasts doing Feel Okay. And Zombie doing their cover of Rocket Number 9. And then brand new from Mr. Robert Zimmerman, that's right, Bob Dylan on his website. You can hear it at bobdylan.com. Full Moon and Empty Arms, cover of the song originally done by, done by Mr. Frank Sinatra. And Bob does a pretty good job, as does the band. In a few moments, we're going to be speaking with filmmaker Esther Anderson, who made the great film Bob Marley, Making of a Legend, and we spoke to her at length a while ago when she was in the studio, but she's going to call it Say Hi. We're going to talk about an upcoming Wailers gig right here on LI, so stay tuned for that. Maybe enough art for a while. How about a little rock and roll, right?